This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today, I'm talking to Ramzi Kanaan, one of the founders of PM Press, a radical, I would call, but maybe we can say anarcho-punk-based publishing business. How are you, Ramzi?
I'm fine, thank you. And I'm happy to accept the anarcho-punk moniker.
Well, I know you know, we met each other many, many years ago. And I think when you were in the UK and started a publishing business called AK, having been an anarcho-punk in a band, right? That was sort of how you started.
Yeah. I mean, I came out of, the confluence of radical culture or counterculture or whatever you call it, meaning of the kind of anarcho-punk underground, and that collision and often messy tensions that it had with more formal politics, shall we say. Again, in my case, this would be the anarchist politics. And so those are the two formative pillars of my early teenage years, and they continue to be, meaning the politics and the role that culture plays within politics, I guess, are still the two of the overriding concerns that I still face today, now that I'm, you know, almost five decades later, shall we say.
So when you were younger, did you kind of, you know, the term anarchist or anarcho, you know, is thrown around and sometimes not thoughtfully. And I think you have a kind of strong belief system that's grounded in historical roots. And I'm just curious, like, how do you place yourself in the kind of political tradition of anarchism?
Well, I think one of the beauties of anarchism is that anarchism is not a fixed set of ideology or dogma or any positive or negative connotations to those kind of words. Meaning anarchism to me, and I think historical or classical anarchism, has always been a process. You know, anarchism is a set of ideas and a set of practices. And unlike most other ideas, it's not about the correct interpretation of the holy texts. You know, most other modern, certainly left-wing ideologies are named after the person, the founder. You know, Marxism or Leninism or Maoism or Trotskyism. And so the arguments are often about the correct interpretation of the holy books. And I think one of the things that distinguishes anarchism, and I do consider anarchism to be part of that left, with a capital L, from the other varieties of the left, is that anarchism has always been part of a process. And so while there are foundational ideas, you know, some of which are you're seeing a resurgence of, such as mutual aid, for example, being against the state, being against capitalism, for collective action, you know, the belief that a change can only occur when it's a collective process. Anarchism doesn't believe in the Big Bang theory of revolution. It's not that we'll wake up one day, the day after the revolution, and things will be great. So, I say, to me, anarchism, I would call myself a classic anarchism, but with those caveats that anarchism is actually, if not a moving target, it's a series of processes. So in that sense, I'm proud to place myself as part of that tradition, if indeed I'm worthy of that tradition.
At one time, I think when I was young, I thought that I would categorize myself as an anarcho-Buddhist, which in a lot of ways is similar to what you've just described. Buddhism being, in fact, a practice and a process, although there are those who proclaim it's got sacred texts, you know, and that many others in Buddhism believe that it is a process, the same way you've just described anarchism. In any case, that's what attracted me to it. I don't think, I'm not interested in structure so much. And I think, although it is, you know, there's, and you participate in this as I've done, that when you're trying to build alternatives, you end up, in fact, having to wrestle with the idea of structure and creating an entity that has some sort of formality to it in order for it to continue to exist. So you know, there's almost a day-to-day contradiction.
See, I would not posit that as a contradiction. For me, anarchism is a set of processes, and it's a set of, frameworks on both how do we create a better world for all, or at least for the majority of its inhabitants. I mean, to be honest, I don't really care about the rich. I don't want to create a better world for them. But nevertheless, if we believe that, you know, creating a better world is a collective action, I think anarchism is a different form of structures or a different form of frameworks. I mean, the way society is organized is a series of hierarchies, right? The rulers and the rich and the kings and the presidents and the apparatus which ensures their continuation are on top. And then, you know, the pyramid continues downwards and the vast majority of the inhabitants of this earth are at the bottom, supporting those supposed betters. So I think for me, anarchism is actually a form of organization. It's just a form of more overlapping and horizontal forms of organization as opposed to these hierarchical, top-down, vertical forms of organization. And I actually think that as we've both been struggling all of our lives, is how do we actually build institutions that can both further those aims, meaning, you know, I believe that the publishing efforts I've been involved in for more than 45 years now and the dissemination of ideas that I've been involved in for more than 45 years, to me, that's my modest contribution to making a better world. That's what I found I was reasonably good at and, you know, somewhat successful at. And so I say that's my contribution as opposed to the myriad of other ways that people contribute to making a better world. But to do so, I actually do think that structure and institutions are crucially important, not just the ways to facilitate that change in those processes, but also how do people come in? How do people come into movements? How do people plug in? How are people able to learn? And it's all through institutions. I mean, when I was a kid, I was very disdainful of those institutions that I viewed as contrary to my beliefs, my ideology, and my practices. But I slowly started to realize that every time I went to a meeting, it was either in a building that was either owned by the Communist Party or by the Quakers. And whatever problems I have with the Communist Party, which are myriad, and with the Quakers, which are myriad, though probably less intense, nevertheless, I came to realize and appreciate the fact that they were actually building institutions and they were building the wherewithal for the likes of a 15-year-old to actually come into contact, to be able to organize, to actually have some of those tools to be able to facilitate that collective action. So again, for me, building, whether I was involved in actively involved in the punk rock underground, you know, playing in a band and organizing, self-organizing, touring the world and whatever, or building publishing and distribution companies, it's how are these microcosms not only as ways of changing the world, but of ways that we'd prefer to live in the here and now. So how can we organize our institutions that while they hopefully endure, that the institutions themselves are not, you know, replicating those hierarchical tendencies, shall we say. And it's always a struggle. It's always a tension, as you posited. You know, we're in many ways, we're kind of making this up as we go along, because there are no long-standing institutions that we can draw upon. There are no long-standing examples that we can draw upon, typically because they've been smashed by the powers that be because they see them as a threat.
That's true. And I think what's interesting is how long you've been able to maintain the structure or build a structure, I assume evolving over time, but PM Press has now been going for quite a number of years, almost 20 years.
Yep, It's true. And I say it's been, I mean, when we started PM Press, we had the benefit of the previous 25 years of experience. In one sense, when you know what you're doing, producing really good books is the easy part. As I say, after a while, you understand what makes a good book. You understand that if you're willing to take the time and care in terms of production and editorial and copy editing and proofreading and indexing and all the stuff, which this has largely gone out of the window, you know, to make it supposedly more profitable. But if you understand what you're doing, to me, it's the easy part is actually producing the material and making it look good and read good and appear attractive and appealing and in ways that people are able to interact with it. The challenge for me, and the same the challenge as when I was a 30-year-old, and it's now that I'm 60, the challenge is the same as how do we disseminate those ideas? How do we get people to actually interact with them? How do we get them in front of people's eyeballs or their ears? As I say, if you know what you're doing, the act of production is relatively simple. And if you're willing to take the time and energy and expense, you can produce really good stuff. The challenge has always been, particularly, you know, where there's more and more stuff being produced every day. I mean, what was it, 20 years ago now, that there's more than 1 million books published in America alone every year? So there's more and more stuff coming out, more and more, most of which, of course, is utter garbage. But the challenge remains and has become intensified of how do we actually disseminate those ideas?
I think that what you just described is what every publisher feels today, I think, in their bones. It is completely clear. We know how to make books. We can do that part pretty easily. But finding readers or allowing readers to find us, find the books, is really a huge challenge. I think, as you said, it's always been a challenge, but I think there are unique characteristics of the current environment. It's never been like this before, that there have always been, you know, it's always been difficult to find readers. People are busy. They don't know about you. The means of communication are challenging. But today, the addition of a complete overproduction of information by artificial and human means has created this huge noise level through which it's difficult to either broadcast or discern signal.
I agree. I guess my only caveat would be, so I say I started when I was 13, it was in 1979. So I would argue that my introduction to politics and to the world of disseminating ideas, shall we say, whether that's through punk rock or whether that's through the printed word, I entered the beginning of the long defeat for ideas. You know, the 60s were a massive upsurge, both in terms of ideas and the social movements which, you know, conveyed those ideas and debated those ideas and thrust those ideas, often for the first time. But also the 60s, and again, as you know, when we talk about the 60s, we actually mean kind of realistically 65 to 75. That was also the birth or the reinvention of the ways to disseminate those ideas. So not only was it the birth of, you know, as it was then called, the lesbian and gay movement, or just gay liberation, but it was also the birth of gay literature, which of course didn't exist before then. Similarly, it was the rebirth, you know, second wave of feminism or of Chicano, or, you know, you can go down the list of the 60s. But it wasn't just the birth or the reintroduction of that kind of literature. Women's fiction didn't exist before the 60s, et cetera, et cetera. But it was the way to both produce and then disseminate those ideas. It was the heyday of independent bookstores. It was the heyday of independent publishers, because often no one else is doing it. No one else is going to publish lesbian and gay authors. So you can go down the list. The mainstream has always picked on the superstars, or the kind of like an iceberg, the kind of the tiny bit that appears in the public consciousness. So anyway, so this was the latest great outpouring of radical ideas, but also the ways to disseminate them. By the time I came on the scene in the late 70s, it was the beginning of the end. It was the total destruction. So in 1982, to give you one example of the realities of that, in 1982, I applied to join the Federation of Radical Booksellers in the UK. And at the time, the FRB had 52 members. As a 15-year-old, I was denied membership, not because of my youth and not because of the kind of material I was distributing and starting to publish, but because I did not have a storefront. To be a member of the FRB, you actually had to have a storefront. So in Britain, in the UK in 1982, there was not only was there 52 independent bookstores, but there was 52 independent bookstores that self-identified as being radical bookstores. Again, they ran the gamut: women's bookstores, LGBT bookstores, you know, anarchist bookstores, socialist bookstores, Irish bookstores, anti-nuclear bookstores, etc. My point is that 4 or 5 years later, within the UK, the FRB folded because there was only 6 bookstores left. And this is still in the 80s. And again, we can go through the long list of, you know, of, as everyone's painfully aware of the big bastards moving in, you know, conglomerizing everything and gobbling up all the independent publishers and the chains taking on all the bookstores. But I'm saying for the last 50 years almost, the book trade, or the way that we disseminate ideas, has been in decline. So I agree with you that we're in particularly egregious situations. I would argue that the book trade was already mortally wounded even before the advent of Amazon. And it's within that context that I've been struggling, again, as we've been talking about, how do you disseminate ideas? If the book trade itself has been failing, or failing to as you posited, connect with readers, to find readers, to let readers even know that we exist, then how do we do it out with the book trade?
Well, and I think without distracting us from what I wanted, I think what you've just led us to talk about, in the US, I think the environment was a little different than it was in the UK. And in the 80s into the 90s, there were still really large numbers of what I would, and I think you'd agree, would be called alternative or radical or politically active, culturally active bookstores well into the 90s. But the same dynamic was at play, and that was the conglomerization of retail bookselling, and then later the arrival of Amazon pretty much destroyed that ecosystem that was pretty strong up until, you know, the early 90s, and did provide at the same time, and it was not just the advent of independent bookstores, but of independent publishing, which was massively productive through the 80s and into the 90s, and still today.
No, absolutely. But I'm saying that, but the long decline, it's already started.
Yeah. I think the cultural efflorescence of the period we call the 60s had a downstream effect, and definitely has declined in to the point now where it's almost invisible. Sure. But what I think you've done as a publisher, I think, is really important, because you've worked at different ways of finding direct connections between you and readers, you being the publisher and readers for the books you publish, in ways that I think many publishers have either not found possible or have struggled with over time. And I think there are some characteristics of what you've done that are important for making that possible. But I think one of the things you've done a lot you've made connections with rock and roll, which I think I don't know how to, that's probably rock and roll is the wrong terminology, but with music venues to be able to sell books in those environments, which I think is, you know, really different than most publishers have been able to do.
Sure. I mean, I think part of that is, well, I say part of that is by necessity. So, you know, we made great efforts to do it, you know, in the years prior to PM Press, and we just continued that. I mean, I think our strength has been constantly, as I say, trying to find ways to sell books. I mean, to put it in crude terms, how do we shift units if the book trade is failing us? Now, that's not to say that we're eschewing the book trade. You know, we've always had formal book trade distributors. But very early on, I mean, so PM Press started in 2007. I think by 2010, we'd already reached a stage where we were selling, both in terms of units and in terms of monetary, more than half was coming not through the book trade. So it meant that early on, as you said, we were always finding ways to take books to the public, to table. And, you know, and we took tabling beyond the formal book fairs, I guess, all of which we try and table at. But, you know, so we were always tabling at demonstrations, always tabling at, as you said, different music concerts. And part of it is just following our passions. You know, personally, you know, I grew up, the two forms of music that interested me were punk rock and folk music. And that was partly because they were two of the genres that were more explicitly political, shall we say. Whereas the other genres of music that were more or less explicitly political, like say jazz or reggae, I had no personal musical interest in those genres of music. But nevertheless, the logic would be, if I'm personally interested in something, then, you know, I'm going to do my damnedest to try and inject some politics into it in that sense. So we instead of just attending concerts, we'd also set up a book table at those concerts. That was partly by having venues that were okay with us doing that, or happy for us to do that. It'd be working with promoters in certain ways. It's also working with bands or the management. But the same would be, say, of, as I say, contacting, you know, the organizers of the Women's March or whatever. These days, you know, the local organizers of No Kings demonstrations are saying, can we come on table?
Have you thought about ways of kind of extending that beyond? I remember a few years ago, I talked to a guy in New York who was a black publisher who he was only selling on the street. He had no distribution, and all of the books he produced, and sometimes sold books by other publishers to augment his own output, but all of his publishing was done outside of formal structures and in with a network of people that he enlisted to set up tables and sell his books, you know, not just himself, but, you know, kind of an informal sales network that I thought was brilliant.
So, yeah, we do all of that and more, in the sense of, you know, we've always had paid staff people do events. We also have a bunch of volunteers and helpers who, you know, in effect get paid on commission. And as I say, we will table anywhere that we realistically think we can sell books. Now, setting up randomly on the street is realistically not,
right,
not something that most people can do or have the time and energy. It's certainly not economically viable. But we have pioneered tabling at flea markets. We have pioneered tabling at craft fairs. We've pioneered tabling at farmers markets. So anywhere where we think, you know, we can do that, we do it regularly. I mean, I think last year we tabled at more than 200 events, public events. I say that's not including author, you know, our authors being on tour or talking at books. So this is us tabling at non-traditional places. So, you know, we're doing almost, you know, every other day we're somewhere, which means realistically every weekend we're in half a dozen places,
right,
you know, around the country.
So, and what is your relationship now with those independent bookstores that are still culturally, let's say, politically sympathetic to what PM Press does, aside from being able to buy your books through a distributor, which is obviously important, but do you have yourself direct relationships with numbers of bookstores who are more, maybe closer than just being customers?
Yes. So we've always, again, I say always, from day one, we've cultivated those relationships, because often those bookstores or those outlets for books are off the radar, again, for obvious reasons. It's not economic for sales reps to visit or contact these bookstores. You know, many of these bookstores don't use Edelweiss currently or whatever. So yes, we have a whole network of independent bookstores or more social centers or info shops or whatever that we've always dealt with directly. And similarly, we've been fairly deliberate about cultivating places that are not traditionally not the places that carry books. So I guess the most obvious and famous example was I was the first person, I believe, to sell books to Tower. And this was long before they had a Tower Books. And I made that connection with their magazine, the newsstand people, part of Tower. So I was selling books to the newsstand. And so books went into Tower record stores through the newsstand, since Tower always carried magazines. So it's doing things like that. How do we sell books to comic stores? How do we sell books to record stores? How do we sell books to used bookstores? How do we get them to take new books? So, you know, find how do we sell books to head shops and books that sell tarot cards.
But how do you do that nowadays? Because it is harder, I think. You know, just as you said, you know, sales reps don't go out and comb towns and cities for new outlets. They appear all the time. I noticed in the town I live in, you know, relatively not a small town, but always a town that's had trouble with supporting a bookstore. We have a new bookstore that the owner is struggling. You know, it's hard work to be a bookstore today, you know, doing kind of cultural work. How do you find them when they start? Because they're probably not going to find you that easily.
Well, I'll say there's no easy answer. It's hard work. I mean, the pat answer I always give, not that I'm asked often, if at all, but my answer is, how do we sell more books? My answer is always, we need to build social movements. You know, I gave the example, which I think is pretty irrefutable, that I made the comment earlier that, you know, the last great upsurge of book selling and publishing and distribution came out of the 60s, meaning it came out of these social movements. So, and I think that's been repeated in the last 50 years since the 60s. You know, what was the only year in the middle of COVID that stayed the decline of the book trade for the last 20 years was, of course, during the George Floyd uprising.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the George Floyd uprising was the biggest social movement that the US has ever seen. What do I mean by that? I mean, in terms of, if folks recall, in the summer of 2020, in the middle of COVID, in the middle of lockdown, there was more bodies on the street night after night for several months than ever before in American history. Dwarfed the Vietnam protests, dwarfed the Iraq protests, the Iraq war protests. And unsurprisingly, there was a rise in book sales, particularly in book sales that were addressing, you know, African-American issues, shall we say, or policing, or et cetera, et cetera. That's not a coincidence. And at the end of that movement, the book trade continued its precipitous decline. So as I say, but it's not easy to build social movements. It's as easy to build social movements as to predict the next bestseller in the book trade. You can't. The only way you can do it is by patient, hard work, which is typically not economically rewarding. But again, I guess that's the advantage that we have over most other typical publishers, is that we're, I guess it would be the cliche, we were mission-driven. What that means in reality is we're willing to vastly self-exploit ourselves. So, you know, we're paid really low wages and we work really long hours because we believe in the end product and the hoped-for effects of those end products, I guess. But to answer your question in a more direct manner, you know, how do we make those connections? Well, by painstaking hard work, by taking lots of time and energy, and, you know, and it takes time.
Right. No, I think that is sort of the answer to a lot of questions about how do you offset the massive power of, you know, mainstream culture, which tends toward efficiency and depersonalization. The only answer is being less efficient and more personal.
Absolutely. It's all about that personal connection.
Right.
You know, none of us like dealing with robocalls or dealing with press one if you want this and press two. So, you know, getting on the phone or doing personalized non-mass emails or however you communicate these days, personal DM messages, I guess the youngsters do. That's the only way to build.
Do you find that, speaking of younger people, are you attracting younger people to come work with you and kind of be part of what you're doing and bring with them new ideas and new connections?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the only way forward. I mean, I personally have never been on social media. I mean, I've always hated it for personal and political and practical reasons. I hate that, you know, instant gratification economy, if you like. So, you know, I don't text for the same reason. But fortunately, you know, PM has a large cohort of people that are under 40 and a smaller cohort of people that are under 30. You know, and it's those generations we have two people that work on our social media, and I think they do it very well. But again, the reason they do it very well is not just because they're technically proficient and they understand the ever-changing algorithms and how to, you know, blah-de-blah, but actually because they're connected. You know, presumably our success insofar as our social media is successful is because we're helping to build an audience and we do stuff that resonates with an audience that's not just about selling them stuff.
Right. So you build, well, and you have kind of the monthly supporter model, which is I can pay you a monthly amount and get all of your books.
Correct.
I think that's a kind of example of personal connection that means your customers are closer to you than just being consumers.
Yeah. And that's been a major way that we've tried to build both that connection, but also those direct sales. So, you know, we have almost 1,000 people that get books every month. So as a publisher, you know, we're guaranteed.
Right.
So again, that affects our print runs. It means that we can take slightly more political editorial decisions, shall we say. Obviously any editorial decision is greatly economically based, but it means that we have more wiggle room because we have those guaranteed sales. You know, we were pioneers again, we were not the first people to invent a subscription scheme. You know, obviously publishers have been doing that for hundreds of years, but I think we were very successful in popularizing it and showing that it can be done as an alternative again to the way that stuff used to be done. We were early adopters of Kickstarter. Again, not because our books need the Kickstarter money, but again, we used Kickstarter as a way of making pre-sales, since the main rewards are the books themselves, and as a way of tapping into different communities. You know, so again, we've been somewhat successful in many of our books. We use Kickstarter as a way of also selling the books.
So I know you have a time limit on this call, so I want to ask you just one more question, and it's a little bit open-ended and probably, you know, maybe too vaguely in some ways too vague to be answered. But how do you see let's say if you look ahead to the future, what is it that you find most interesting, exciting, and also most challenging over the next few years?
Well, I have to be honest. I think that the future looks really bleak. I think it's really depressing for me personally and for the rest of the world. But as I say, taking the longer view, I would argue that both politically and in terms of the book world, we've been in defeat ever since I've been involved. So for the last 50 years, you know, we've been fighting these rearguard actions and struggling to adapt. So in one sense, I think the future is very bleak. I think nevertheless, that means we have two choices, both in publishing and in our more overtly political lives. We either give up or we carry on. Then, you know, that's our two choices, right? We can either stick our heads in the sand.
Yep.
Or we can carry on. What gives me optimism is that radical stuff happens all the time. And just to loop it back to, I think, the importance of institutions, I think it's building those institutions and building those frameworks which will actually push things forward. As I just mentioned, the biggest mass movement ever in British history was the George Floyd uprising, but that only lasted a few months because I don't think there was that left institutional backing. There was, you know, after it dissipated and after it was smashed by law enforcement, etc., there was nowhere for it to go. There was nowhere for it to build upon. Again, previously you could say 15 years ago, it was the same with the Occupy movement.
Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing.
But, you know, so how do we build the structures that these are not one-offs, so they're not spectacular defeats, but they can actually add to the building for the future? And as we said, it's not easy. It's a struggle, but our choice is, what was the old slogan? You know, peace or annihilation.
Yeah. Well, there is no quitting. You can't quit. So you got to keep going. Well, I want to thank you for doing this, Ramsey. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I really admire what you've done. I think that anyone who's listening here, please visit PM Press. The books are incredible and really important and are invaluable. So I just want to compliment you on the work and thank you for everything you've done, because I think it really makes a difference.
Well, I thank you for your work, but you know, me doing the work is a pleasure. You know, I'm fortunate that I can have a day job where I think, as I say, I'm making some contribution to a better world. That makes me very fortunate and lucky and unusual.
That's true. Well, it's appreciated. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. I've been talking to Ramsey Kanaan about PM Press. This is David Wilk, and thank you for listening.